Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Television used to be so simple. You sat on the couch, you grabbed the clicker, and boom, you were done. Now, you gotta go to the Supreme Court. Modern technology, am I right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 22nd of April. Great, as always, to have you here. The justices would rather not let television cameras in the Supreme Court, but television was where it was at argument this morning. A case officially called American Broadcasting Corporation, that is ABC, the television network, versus Aereo. Aereo wants to make money by replaying over-the-air television broadcasts online, in very simple terms. ABC and its fellow networks would rather not let him do that. Marketplace's David Gura was in the court chamber this morning for arguments. Hey, David.
Hey, Kai.
Do me a favor and lay out the technology at issue here for me, would you?
So this is a pretty new company. It's been around just a couple of years. They're in 13 markets across the country. And what Aereo lets you do is watch TV on your computer, on your tablet, on your TV if you choose to do so, over the internet. And what you get is your own little antenna the size of a dime, mm-hmm. and access to a DVR. When you go online and say you want to watch the ball game tonight, you can turn that on, start streaming it on your tablet, or you can set up the DVR to record that game. You can go back and watch it later. But what it is, and what Aereo stresses, is this one-to-one relationship. You're just paying a monthly fee to be able to do it.
Sounds reasonably straightforward. That is, however, rarely the way things go once arguments start, right? What was the conversation in the courtroom today?
Yeah, you learn a lot being in the room and sort of hearing the give and take between the attorneys and the justices. For instance, Sonia Sotomayor today revealed that she owns a Roku.
Oh.
Chief Justice John Roberts brought up Radio Shack a number of times. Perhaps he still shops there. You had Justice Scalia displaying some facility with the way that HBO works.
Or not.
And Stephen Breyer, Justice Breyer, who was making a lot of analogies to a record store. And by that, I mean a store that sells phonographs. So it is some insight into sort of how in touch the justices are with where technology is today.
How in touch, yes. Loosely using that phrase.
Out of touch, sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. So what were the arguments? Once the lawyer started talking, what were the arguments?
So the argument that Aereo makes, again, is this sort of one-to-one relationship makes it totally legal. In other words, Kai, you could buy an antenna and mm-hmm. a DVR at your house and do all this for free. The channels are free. They're broadcast channels. Right. You can pull them in yourself. And Aereo says that they're just doing that, but at a facility offsite from your house. So that's the argument that they're making. And they do charge you a fee. They're charging you about $8 a month on the low end to stream it on your tablet or on your PC. The argument that the broadcasters are making is that Aereo has no right to do this, that the broadcasters invest billions of dollars mm-hmm. every year into creating this content that they pump out through their affiliates. And what Aereo is doing is kind of freeloading off of that. And the broadcasters, those who are making the content, aren't seeing a dime from that.
Is this, as has been said at various points of analysis today, either the future of broadcast television or the future of cloud computing on the line here? Is that what's going on?
Well, we heard arguments on both sides on both of those issues, and some attorneys were saying, do think about this in the context of the cloud. We are putting more stuff, music, video, documents mm-hmm. up in the cloud. What could this mean depending on how the court rules? The more salient argument here is about money. And, right now, if you're a cable subscriber, you're able to watch your local affiliate on cable.
Yeah.
The reason for that is that cable companies pay the broadcasters to be able to do that. They put up a big antenna, bring down this programming, and they send it out to all right. of us. The problem here is that if the court were to side with Aereo, the cable companies could very easily say, look, if Aereo is able to do this for free, if they're able to capture those signals and push them out to their subscribers, why couldn't the cable companies do the same thing? That is, pay the broadcasters nothing, and that could really throw the business model of broadcast TV out of whack.
Pandemonium, baby. Follow the money. David Gura in Washington for us. Thank you, David.
Thanks, Kai.
On Wall Street today, a nifty little performance by the three major indices. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. drugstore chain CVS is out with a new take on the Affordable Care Act. Later this spring, customers will be able to pay their health insurance premiums right in the store. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains why CVS would want to get into the business of taking other people's payments and also what could possibly go wrong.
Right now, maybe you see your local CVS as someplace you can grab a bag of chips and a candy bar. You spend a buck or two. CVS wants you to spend a lot more than that. Jen Lynch is vice president for equity research at BMO Capital Markets. She says CVS wants to give you one more reason to drop by.
Whenever you can provide a new service, you can help increase your foot traffic to the stores.
CVS hopes more foot traffic will equal more sales. It wants to be your soup-to-nuts healthcare supplier, peddling everything from
Band-Aids to Q-tips to prescriptions to getting checked for strep throat.
That's George Hill. He's the healthcare services analyst at Deutsche Bank. He says there are potential pitfalls to this strategy. CVS has to be careful it doesn't get dragged down into the healthcare world's technical mire, because if there are problems with the processing of the premiums, it might not be totally CVS's fault.
But it will be CVS where the patient is standing and frustrated.
Another potential problem? Consumers could stop thinking of CVS as a retailer. Ross Mukin is a CVS analyst at ISI Group.
Do I stop in a Dollar General for a convenience item as opposed to a CVS because I now think of CVS as being a healthcare provider?
After all, CVS still wants you to buy the chips and the candy bar, just not until after you paid your health insurance premium and picked up your prescription. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There was a tidy intersection of sports and business today. The English Premier League soccer team Manchester United fired its manager, its coach, after he'd had the job for less than a full season. And the company's stock promptly jumped 6%. David Moyes is his name. He took over from the legendary Alex Ferguson. And almost as soon as Moyes walked in the door, the team's performance began to suffer. The final straw came last week when United missed qualifying for a Champions League for the first time in nearly 20 years. A very, very big deal over there where they play football. Marketplace's Bree Benishore has more on the sports and business compare and contrast.
In sports, it seems so easy.
David Moyes has been fired as manager of Manchester United.
The Knicks fired head coach Mike Woodson today.
The U.S. national team coach has been fired.
Why isn't it like this for CEOs? Well, it kind of is, actually.
The probability of a succession event is higher following poor performance.
Melissa Aguilar is a researcher with the Conference Board, and notice she said succession event. She didn't say firing.
Not everything that gets called a retirement is necessarily a retirement, I guess is the best way to say.
In the corporate world, if something's screwed up, you don't really want to publicize it. Whereas in sports, it's all about publicizing it. You can't win spectacularly unless somebody loses spectacularly. And when it comes to losing, shareholders have nothing on angry sports fans.
Almost anybody would agree that very few sports fans are rational.
Matteo Arena teaches finance at Marquette University.
Most fans react to poor results in a very passionate way and put a lot of pressure on teams.
That pressure is why sports teams often ditch their coaches or managers so quickly. And Arena says, remember, a team can lose 10 games in a month, but for a corporation, 10 quarters of bad earnings results takes 2.5 years. Lastly,
in more than 50% of publicly traded companies in the U.S., the CEO is also the chair of the board.
How easy do you think it is to remove the guy in charge if he's in charge of removing the guy in charge? In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Sometime this spring, the Obama administration is supposed to share the details of its plan to rate colleges on measures like value and affordability. The idea, which is not without controversy, is that if students can compare schools on how much it's going to cost them, or graduation rates, or even how much money students earn after they graduate, those schools might have to step it up. Especially if, as proposed, poor performers would risk losing access to federal financial aid. All of that naturally makes colleges just a bit nervous, so a liberal arts school in New York is fighting back with its own way of measuring value. From the education desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott has our story.
Okay, since we're all here, let's just dive right into our discussion of Northanger Abbey, picking up where we left off last time.
At Sarah Lawrence College in Bronxville, New York, about 10 students, all women but one, sit at a round table discussing Jane Austen.
But would you begin midway through 145, but your father?
But your father, said Catherine, was he afflicted?
For a time, greatly so.
The 88-year-old college has a reputation for doing things differently. Most classes here are small seminars like this one. There are no majors. Students do a lot of independent projects. And grades aren't as important as the long written evaluations professors give every student at the end of every semester. It's no surprise, then, that Professor James Horowitz is skeptical of any uniform college rating system.
The goals that we are trying to achieve in instructing our students might be very different from what the University of Chicago or a state school or a community college might be striving to achieve.
So in the past few years, Sarah Lawrence has created its own system to measure what students are actually getting out of college. The faculty came up with 6 abilities they think every Sarah Lawrence graduate should have. They include the ability to write and communicate effectively, to think analytically, to accept and act on critique. Computer science professor Michael Siff helped develop the tool.
We don't believe that there's like 100 things you should know when you graduate. It's much more about, are you a good learner, right? You know, do you know how to enter into a new domain and attack it with an open mind, but also an organized mind?
Advisors can use the results to track students' progress over time and help them address any weaknesses. A student who's struggling with communication could take a class with a lot of oral presentations, for example, or make an appointment at the campus writing center. But Siff says the tool is also about figuring out what the college can do better.
This tool would allow us to assess ourselves as an institution. How good a job are we imparting what we believe to be these critical abilities?
So how is the school doing? So far, there are only 2 semesters worth of data. But on every measure, seniors do better than juniors, and sophomores do better than freshmen. Starting next fall, faculty advisors will meet with their students at the beginning of each semester to talk over their progress.
Do you see an area where you feel like, boy, I really feel like I could push this better?
Well, obviously, I want to get excellent on everything.
Obviously.
In a sort of trial run, Siff goes over the results so far with one of his advisees, junior Zachary Deggy. On a scale from not yet developed to excellent, he's mostly at the top end. Deggy says he likes seeing his own growth.
I think the thing I like most about this is just the fact that I can look back at how I was doing in previous semesters and sort of chart my own progress, not comparing me towards, you know, other students, just me to myself.
That's a different measure of the value of an education than, say, student loan debt or earnings after graduation, the sorts of things the Obama administration is considering as part of its ratings plan. The college's president, Karen Lawrence, says students and parents are right to ask if they're getting their money's worth. After financial aid, the average cost of a Sarah Lawrence education is almost $43,000 a year.
People are worried about cost. We understand that.
And they're worried about getting jobs after graduation. But she says the abilities the new assessment measures, critical thinking and innovation and collaboration, are the same ones employers say they're looking for.
We think these are abilities that students are going to need both right after graduation and in the future. And so it could be an interesting model.
One she hopes other schools will take a look at as they figure out how to answer the national debate about the value of college. In Bronxville, New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, the booming business of end-of-life care.
The company that owns Roto-Rooter is the owner of the largest hospice chain in the country.
What else is there to say, really? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 65 points today, 0.4%, closed at 16,514. The NASDAQ up 39 points, we'll call that 1%, finished at 4,161. The S&P 500 added 7 points, 0.4%, 1879. Netflix beamed up 7% today. The video streaming service said after the bell yesterday that quarterly earnings were way, way up. Harley Davidson revved up more than 6% on strong global sales. McDonald's, however, slimmed down a third of 1% due to rising beef prices and fewer U.S. customers last quarter. Allergan puffed up 15%. The maker of Botox is the object of a $45 billion takeover bid. That from activist investor William Ackman and Valeant Pharmaceutical. Valeant up 7.5% today. Bond prices were steady. The yield on the 10-year T-note, likewise, 2.71%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes in March. Domestic flights got a little less cloudy on April 23, 1988, when a smoking ban on trips under 2 hours went into effect. Does anyone actually tamper with those bathroom smoke detectors? And for fresher air, why not pack up some lunch and go outside? It's National Picnic Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The national unemployment rate, the last time the Bureau of Labor Statistics checked for us, was 6.7%. That varies regionally, of course. The Southeast United States has counties where more than 15% of the people don't have jobs. This, however, is not a story about one of those places. WPLN's Blake Farmer takes us to Lincoln County on the Tennessee-Alabama border, where just about everybody who wants a job seems to have one.
This county of rolling farmland dotted with rusty silos and wooden barns has just 33,000 residents. Fewer than 900 are considered jobless. In some months, the county has had the lowest unemployment in Tennessee. A handful of factories drive the local economy. Goodman Manufacturing, by far, is the largest.
Most everybody I know that wants a job's got a job.
Jonathan Smith, his sister, and both parents work here. In all, 1,500 employees build HVAC units. It's hard work, but the pay is good for the area, $17 an hour. Louise Alawena left the local hospital to take a welding job.
You can only clean so many toilets and stuff. Make up beds, then you come out here and you get a taste of really working.
And this factory is still hiring. Instead of importing components from China, Goodman fabricates its own parts so it can respond to market demands. And there's very little automation, which has meant people remain important to the process. Plant manager Bill Miller says there's so much variability between small AC units for homes all the way to monster machines meant for hotels.
Robots are very difficult to program for that kind of complexity. Human beings are very trainable for that kind of complexity.
While Goodman has stuck around for decades, Lincoln County has lost some companies who found it more profitable to move overseas. But the area has also recruited new employers to replace them.
We're lucky, I guess.
Mayor John Ed Underwood doesn't take much credit for the economic good fortune. He finds corporate recruiting to be a game of chance. One executive recently showed up on a Learjet.
We talked with him. We would have thought we'd done a good job of selling Lincoln County Federal to him. He got on his plane, and we ain't heard from him since.
Really, Lincoln County has held its own against the odds. It has no interstate. A nearby freight rail line was recently shut down, and there's no booming industry. Underwood figures there's just been a good balance of people and jobs.
Those are the bells at the top of the county courthouse. Looking around the town square here, not a lot of big employers, a jewelry store, a barber shop, a couple of little restaurants. For those who don't work in one of the county's factories, many of them head south across the Alabama line each morning.
My name is Deidre Smith. I work in Huntsville, Alabama. I know several people that do.
Hundreds of people make that commute. Many work at Redstone Arsenal in Huntsville. Smith has an administrative job at a doctor's office. She says she had to leave Lincoln County to find white-collar work after a job at a clothing factory.
I chose that would not be my profession always.
Lincoln's lack of non-factory work is a problem, but most counties this size would trade places in a heartbeat. Other rural areas, even just a few counties away, are battling double-digit unemployment. In Lincoln County, Tennessee, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
It was, by corporate layoff standards, pretty small. But the news the other day that Nike is going to lay off people from the group that makes Fuel Bands, those wrist bracelet fitness tracking things that were oh so hot for a while, offers a commentary on the business merits of wearable technologies. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark has the story.
In the beginning, there was the good old wristwatch. What you could call one of the first examples of wearable technology. Angela McIntyre is with the tech research firm Gartner. She says now wearable technology can do a lot more than tell the time.
Perhaps track the motions that you're doing or your heartbeat or control your thermostat.
And while Nike may be stepping back from manufacturing its own wristband activity tracker, that area between your arm and your hand is still shaping up to be a very hot place for tech innovation. Apple is expected to come out with an iWatch sometime this year. Google has been developing an operating system just for watches and other wristy gadgets. Chris Jones is with the tech analyst firm Canalys.
We expect great growth in this market over the next few years.
Last year, Jones says just over 7 million of these smart bands sold around the world. And he says that number could triple by next year. But other body parts, don't fear. You will get cool technology too, says David Gallagher. He works for a wearable tech company called iOne Biometrics.
We develop mouth guards that go in the mouths of football players to sense whether or not they've suffered impacts that might warrant them from being pulled from the game.
And then there are smart band-aids that track your hydration and smart tattoos with RFID chips you can plant under your skin. Only the tech crazed are using this kind of stuff now, but Gallagher says soon they might be as common as a wristwatch used to be. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, tells us that about 2.5 million people die in this country every year. Almost half of those people, 44% to be just a bit more precise, are dying in hospice care. That is a cultural change, to be sure, but it's also a business opportunity. Fran Smith wrote a book about hospital care. It's called Changing the Way We Die. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
Hospice care is a $14 billion a year industry?
Yeah, you know, it's actually going up. Yeah. It was 14 when we wrote the book a year ago, by the time the book came out, it was already a $17 billion a year industry.
Other than the fact that we all eventually have to die, what is driving that?
Well, it's the aging of the population, and it's the fact that lots of people don't want to die in hospitals, don't want to die in intensive care units, and for people who want to die at home in comfort, hospice is the best way to go.
And it is also for profit.
Yeah, that was one of the biggest surprises for us, is it started off 40 years ago in this country, exactly 40 years ago, as a grassroots cause, all nonprofit. And increasingly, it's a for-profit venture. More than half of hospice programs are run by for-profit companies, more and more big publicly traded chains. And all the growth in hospice over the past 10 years has been in the for-profit sector.
Also, one has to point out, baffling though it may be, Roto-Rooter bought into hospice care?
Well, the company that owns Roto-Rooter, ChemMed, is the owner of the largest hospice chain in the country, VITAS.
You have called hospice care the most successful part of the American healthcare industry. Why do you say that?
Well, in terms of family satisfaction, patient satisfaction, across the board, families, patients just are so happy with the care. And, you know, some of that is beginning to change as you see more and more for-profit ventures come in. But historically, that has been the case. It's also cost-effective. Hospice saves money.
Are we good enough consumers to recognize a good thing when we see it? Or do we try to hold on, I guess, to the bitter end and then only go to hospice as a last resort?
Well, most people come in hospice very, very late. Medicare, most private insurance companies pay for hospice care when a patient has a terminal diagnosis and a life expectancy of 6 months to live. And the median length of service is 19 days or 20 days. And a third of patients come in the final week of life. So people are, you know, getting treatment, getting chemo, getting ICU, going back and forth to the emergency room until the bitter end often. And then hospice just becomes the last stop instead of a great service that they can
avail themselves to.
Is this profitable? I mean, if businesses are getting into it because it's a business, are they making money?
Oh, they're making a lot of money. And there's a lot of concern about the way for-profits are making money. There's pretty good research evidence that shows that they for-profits tend to cherry-pick the most profitable patients, which tend to be patients with dementia, Alzheimer's, patients who will stay on hospice care a long time. So there's lots of money being made in hospice care right now.
Fran Smith, with her co-author Sheila Himmel, wrote a book called Changing the Way We Die. It's about the hospice movement. Fran, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, by the end of which you will all be screaming, I tell you, to get into Bitcoin. I saw this in the Wall Street Journal this morning, that money is even dirtier than your mother told you it was. The Dirty Money Project at NYU did what is called the first comprehensive study of the DNA that is often found on dollar bills. And I'm just going to read off some of the stuff they found. You guys, try to control your gag reflexes, all right? There was the bacteria that causes acne. Fine. Others, though, were linked to gastric ulcers, pneumonia, food poisoning, and staph infections. They found, quote, extremely minute traces of anthrax and diphtheria, DNA from horses and dogs, also white rhinos. So, go wash your hands, will you? Come on. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this Tuesday. Nancy Fargali is our senior producer of special projects. Caitlin Esch works on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin and Shay Huffman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. And I'm serious about that wash your hands thing. Dangerous out there. This is 8 p.m.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.